Welcome to the Raisana podcast from the Observer Research Foundation. Russia is a significant global player as well as an important strategic partner of India. In this episode of the Raisana podcast, we talk not only about the role of Russia in the modern world, but look at some of the domestic issues faced by the country. We discuss these matters with Dr. Vyacheslav Nikonov, a member of the Russian Parliament. Dr. Nikonov has been a member of the staff of Presidents Mikhail Gorbachev, Boris Yeltsin, and Vladimir Putin, and is thus well-versed with the intricacies of Russian domestic and foreign policies.
Welcome to this episode of the Raisina podcast. Today, we are going to be talking about Russia, an important global player. To talk to us about Russia, Russia's domestic and foreign policies, we have Dr. Vyacheslav Nikonov. I don't think he requires an introduction, but I'll do my duty. Mr. Nikonov is a senior Russian politician who is currently a member of the Duma and the head of the Education and Science Committee. Mr. Nikonov is also a noted political scientist and is an author of several books. He has been at the heart of the Soviet and Russian systems since the 1970s. He has been on the staff of President Gorbachev, President Yeltsin, and President Putin. So he is really continuity in Russian politics. But before we start, there is a vignette that I must give all of you, is that Vyacheslav Nikonov is also the grandson of the famous Soviet foreign minister, Mr. Vyacheslav Molotov, in whose honor Mr. Nikonov is named. Welcome, Mr. Nikonov, to the Raisina podcast.
Hello, Nandan. Thank you.
Russia had a particularly difficult period with the COVID pandemic. And in that sense, we in India can appreciate the difficulties of dealing with this disease. But tell us about the social and economic impact of the pandemic so far.
Well, of course, the consequences of the pandemic in Russia are pretty sad, as elsewhere else. The economy is down in the second quarter at around 6%, some say up to 8%. It's bad, and many businesses see the consequences. They're struggling. But the third quarter, I think, started much better, and now the economy is on the rise again. As for social consequences, I would probably say that the society has become sort of more nervous, maybe, because several months of isolation or self-isolation do not work well for psyche. And in general, I would consider the consequences as being serious, but of course nothing tragic for the Russian Federation. And it's looked like that Russia is handling this crisis much better than many other countries, and of course much better than any Western country doing now in terms of the amount of infected and especially dead. The crisis still continues, so we do not know what the real consequences will be. But it looks like at this point it can be controlled, especially if the vaccine works and the massive vaccination is going to start in October.
This whole issue of the economy being down, has it resulted in a growth of unemployment? Has it affected the poverty lines?
Actually not, because the government policies were to stimulate the businesses to keep employment. And the enterprises were given actually credits to keep people at their jobs. And there will be no return of these credits if they don't fire people. So there is a strong incentive not to. And there is maybe a 0.5% increase in jobless rate. And of course, there is no serious increase in the amounts of poverty, not yet. Because actually, the government spent quite a lot of money supporting the low-income families. And actually, all the families who have children under 16 got quite a sizable federal support. So I think the government did pretty well in pumping money into the economy, especially to the low-income families and families with the children.
One of the mainstays of the Russian economy is the export of natural resources, particularly oil and gas. But with international demand slowing down because of the pandemic, do you think the Russian economy will still be able to get back to the earlier levels of growth?
Of course, oil and gas is a lot in the Russian economy, but I would not exaggerate their value. In the GDP, it's less than 5%. So the growth is in all other segments of the economy as well. Yes, of course, it's painful for the Russian economy, but the demand for energy is increasing. It's getting back here in Russia and internationally. It has never been lower in such countries as China, for example, which continues growing. And there is a growing Russian energy export into China. Actually, we would like to have more into India, which is also a rapidly growing economy.
Let me move on to a brighter element of this whole pandemic that we are facing. Russia was the first country to certify a vaccine, but immediately it got embroiled in controversy with even the WHO saying that maybe the vaccine did not go through adequate trials and this whole process of the vaccine being coming out so quickly has been somewhat diminished. What is the reaction in Russia to all this?
It's a laughable reaction, of course, because Russians know something about vaccines and viruses. I can remind you that actually the founder of chemistry is Mendeleev. The founder of immunology is Ilya Mechnikov, who was a Nobel Prize winner for immunology back in 1906. And actually, he is leading the list of persons in the amount of Nobel Prize nominations. Number one in the list, by the way, is Ivan Pavlov, who is the founder of physiology. And you may know that antibiotics were invented in the Soviet Union, as well as the vaccines against Ebola, SARS, MERS. And I'm not surprised at all that Russia was first in COVID. So, of course, we know something about that. There are quite a few labs which are working now. The second vaccine is coming from Novosibirsk. And actually, the scientists in Moscow State University just said that by the end of the year, they'll try to have a vaccine which would combine antivirus effects against the flu plus COVID, so to mix them. To have it just one vaccine. And I think it's going to work. Actually, even during World War II, during German invasion, there was no epidemic in the Soviet Union. We know something about this stuff.
Well, that's a nice optimistic view amidst all this depressive news about the pandemic. But tell me, how quickly, if the vaccine works, how quickly will Russia be able to ramp up production, and will Russia be able to provide the vaccine to countries outside the Russian borders?
Well, at this point, there are 27 countries which are interested in testing the Russian vaccine, India included, by the way. So the production will be not just in Russia. We started producing, but it will be not enough for Russia only. So the production will, I think, if it works, will be in many other countries as well. Hope India too. When, hard to say, because we still don't know how effective the vaccine is going to be, for how long the immunity will be from the virus after the vaccination. They say now for about 2 years. maybe. As for the economic results of that, much would depend on the global economy in general, because we are not isolated. We are part of the global economy, so much would depend on how other countries are going to deal with this situation. But in general, I think they have an ambition to have most of the Russian population vaccinated by the end of this year, though it is not obligatory. So I do not know how many people would like to take the vaccine. It's also a complicated social issue, because in Russia, they also read the Western press with all the articles about the how bad Russian vaccine is, which to me, of course, is just one of the signs of competition in pharmaceuticals.
Okay. Just as a curious question, my personal curiosity, tell me, does Russia have any idea of whether it's going to vaccinate people free, or is it going to charge money for the vaccine? And if it's going to charge money, what is the cost of the vaccine?
In Russia, it's free. So it will not cost a thing to anyone.
Okay. So other countries will have to decide their own policies.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, Vyacheslav Alexeyevich, if I may move to matters which are non-pandemic. We have been reading recently about some protests which are on a political ground against the removal of a governor in the Far East, in the town of Khabarovsk. And of course, if you read the Western press, this is almost like the beginning of the end. But what is your idea? What is actually happening on the ground there?
Well, if you read the Western press, Russia has beginnings of the ends every day, I think, at any part of Russia on any issue. But this is not exactly the case. This is a local situation in Khabarovsk where the prosecutors actually found out that the governor, who represents the Liberal Democratic Party, so-called Liberal Democratic Party of Mr. Zhirinovsky, he was elected there and was quite popular, headed a gang back in the 90s, which was responsible for murders. And this is a new criminal case which came out. People disliked the decision to remove the governor, so he's under investigation now. The replacement for the government, the temporary replacement, is from the same party, Liberal Democrats. Though people continue to protest, and a few hundred people every weekend show up on the street of Khabarovsk to protest, I don't think it will spread. I think it is also a reflection of what I said, society getting more nervous because of the virus and all the quarantines we have. But at this point, I do not see the situation spreading even to the neighboring regions of the Far East, where the protest feelings are usually somewhat higher than the Russian average.
But how long is this investigation going to take place? I mean, if it takes place for more than a year, will these protests last for a year?
I don't think so. Actually, the protests are not spreading. They're disappearing. I think it will be faster, and it will not. And the investigation is going on in Moscow. So, and the governor Furgal, who was my colleague in the previous State Duma, he, by the way, was the chairman of Committee on Health in the previous State Duma, yeah. Whom I know pretty well. He's in Moscow, and the trial will be here. So one of the demands for the protesters in Khabarovsk that the trial should be in Khabarovsk. That may be the case. I still don't know, and it's up for investigators now more than for the politicians to deal with the situation.
Now, if I may, move to a more interesting topic, if you want, at least interesting for me. Recently, some constitutional changes were enacted. And, of course, immediately there were concerns expressed all over the world, including maybe in Russia, that this meant that Putin was going to stay in power for at least another 12 years. And this would mean, the 30 years of Putin and things like that. But there were also several other small little changes in that. How important are these constitutional changes, and are they really meant to ensure that Putin is there forever?
When you said some constitutional amendments, you meant 200, because there were 200 amendments in the Constitution. I'm quite involved in the constitutional process in Russia. I was the member of the Constitutional Convention back in 1993. When the nowadays constitution was drafted and then ratified by the referendum. And I was a member, and still am a member, of the working group on those 200 amendments. And I can compare. Actually, there were some birth dramas of the previous constitution. I should remind you that it was adopted immediately after Yeltsin shot at the parliament. You remember?
Yes.
The tanks standing on the bridge and shooting at the Russian parliament and the parliament burning. So that was exactly that constitution. And it was not the best imaginable constitution. First of all, it did not involve great powers to the parliament. As you can imagine, Yeltsin, after shooting the parliament, would not provide great powers to the parliament. Then, of course, the previous constitution was written at a time when Russia planned to become part of the West. And actually, there was nothing in the constitution which would tell it is Russia. The international law, meaning the decisions of European institutions being above the Russian constitution. And, of course, in 1993, the inflation was four-digit in Russia. And there was no way to put any social obligations in the Constitution. So the new constitutional reform was to correct all that. That is to give more powers to the parliament, which is has now power to appoint not just the prime minister, but all ministers of the cabinet, which is a big improvement. Russian constitution is now put above international decisions of international bodies. We have very strict social obligations there, including yearly indexing of pensions and all social benefits is there. And the lower wage, which cannot be lower than living standard, the lowest living standard, this is all in the Constitution now. And as for Putin's terms, yes, now Putin can run in the second election. I don't think he will. He may not. But it will be for people to decide whether he will be next president. It will not be Putin's decision. We're still elections. Putin is popular. He is quite a successful president, maybe one of the most successful leaders in Russia in history. And why limit his terms? Recently I was interviewed by BBC about the terms of the presidency and how bad it is to have unlimited terms. And I asked, do you have any limits for terms for your prime ministers? And they said, no. They don't have it. It's up for the people to decide. So I don't see a big deal with Putin having the right to run next time. He may run, he may not, and will be and the people will decide whether he deserves to be the president.
And now I would like to move to areas of foreign policy, as it were, global issues. One of the things that we see that dominates international affairs right now is the rise of China. And from an Indian standpoint, it is not very harmonious and it is not a quiet rise. It is quite belligerent. And of course, the second issue that is occupying a lot of mind space in people's minds is the forthcoming US election, what it will bring, and whether there will be changes in US foreign policy post-election. So let me start with the second first and ask you, what does Russia expect from the U.S. election?
Okay. Russia does not expect much from the U.S. election. I don't think it's critical whether Trump or Biden going to win. You see, Trump is a good president from just one point of view. He's probably one of the few recent presidents who didn't start a new war, which I think is a huge improvement. Otherwise, in terms of Russia-U.S. relations, Trump was probably worse than all his predecessors in my lifetime, in terms of the amount of sanctions and all sort of nonsense which now exists in the U.S.-Russia relations, the death of arms control, absolute arrogance of American policy in many areas, and so on. So I don't see much of a difference between the candidates as far as Russia-U.S. relations are concerned. And we can see now that America is not a country where policies depends too much on the president. Trump wanted quite a few things, but he couldn't do it because the deep state was against. In the U.S. political system, which is a deep statocracy, it's very hard to make political changes. So I don't think Biden can change the general line of policy of Trump, or Trump can somehow change his nowadays policies in the next administration. But America is now so divided that I cannot think of any coherent American position supported by both parties. Bipartisanship is not there anymore, including foreign policy, except for what the deep state provides. And this actually split in the American society is very deep because it goes through the values, such things as religion, as same-sex marriages, as abortion, race. Those are actually the issues on which there can be no compromise. So American policies are now very uncompromising, and the American political system doesn't function too well. And I think the major change in the position of America in the world recently, especially after the coronavirus crisis, is that American model is not a model for too many countries anymore. I think it cannot even be a model, because American model was to be on top of the food chain, and it's very hard to put your country in the same position. So America is important. It will be important. America's power is diminishing. And America, the superpower with diminishing power, is becoming dangerous. America will fight for the global domination, for its place on top of the food chain. And it can go in for many wars. Unfortunately, Trump is not going into real wars, but his trade wars are here. It's not just with China, it's with the European Union, with Russia, of course, even with India. And I think America will be more advantageous than trying to take advantage of whatever situation in the world in order to keep its primary status.
There is actually a deep conflict between China and India. It is a bordered conflict, and it's over 100 days since the standoff is continuing. And traditionally, India has always had Russia in its corner whenever India has got into a conflict situation. But in recent times, Russia-China relations also have improved considerably. So given the India-China relationship and the Russia-China relationship, how do you view the Russia-India relationship developing?
Well, Russia-India relations are actually unique. We are the only couple of great powers which never had a conflict with each other. All other countries were at wars and confrontations and so on. That's not the case between Russia and India. And that will continue, I think. Russia considers India to be an important strategic partner. Russia would like to increase its trade volume with India. It would like to increase the military technical cooperation. Russia can provide more weapons, and the reason it does not provide more is a decision of the Indian government, which somewhat limits that and also buys weapons in the West, including the United States. As for the conflict between India and China, it's sad, of course, because for us, both India and China are strategic partners. We are partners in BRICS. We are partners in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And for us, of course, this India-China conflicts are very painful. Actually, RIC was invented many years ago by Mr. Primakov in order, among other things, to make India and China closer to each other. And that's what Russia's policies has been for quite a while. And I think today it doesn't change. It doesn't mean that Russia is less sympathetic to India in this situation than it used to be. It is sympathetic to India, but Russia is also a partner to China. And actually, it's becoming more and more so because of American policies. Actually, what Americans did, that they put Russia and China at the same boat, saying that these are the two countries which are the major rivals to the United States of America. You know, they started a policy which I would call dual containment of Russia and China, which make Russia and China natural strategic partners. Actually, of course, Americans at the same time spend much effort on splitting Russia and China, which is now hard to do. American policies are conflicting as oftentimes. So at the same time, they're putting us together. On the other hand, they're trying to move us apart. And it will not work. The second part will not work. Russia and China are cooperating quite closely. China is now our trade partner number one. As for strategic cooperation and military area, of course, Russia-India cooperation is more advanced. And we are providing more advanced weapons system to India than to China, and we're not going to change that. We see all the challenges coming from the rise of China, as we see the rise of India as well. Though I would probably would not say about the rise, it's probably coming back. Because India and China were the greatest global powers just two centuries ago, when India accounted for more than a quarter of the global GDP and China accounted for about a third of the global GDP. And then came Great Britain. And India was 1.5% by the end of the 19th century, and China was around 4%. Now, India and China are coming back, and they are becoming important members of the international community. Russia wants to be friendly with both of them, and that's our position, which is quite natural. And there is nothing which divides India and Russia at this point from the Russian point of view.
To ask you a final question, you're saying that nothing really divides Russia and India. You, at the same time, are suggesting that Russia's relationship with China is unlikely to deteriorate or stagnate because of the kind of policies of dual containment that the U.S. is pursuing. But at the same time, India's relationship with China is rapidly deteriorating. So is there a way out of this conundrum? Will Russia not be forced to choose at some point?
Hope not. We think there are, of course, ups and downs in the India-China relations. There were periods when the countries were in confrontation, where the countries were in closer relations or friendlier relations, and we hope that will improve. We are working for that effect in both Beijing and New Delhi. I think the Russian effort is actually to turn the trend, not to choose. We are not choosing between friends, you know. Friends are friends. In hard times and good times, they are. And if the friends are in quarrel, it's just sad, it's bad. And we will do our best to make you friends again.
Thank you so much, Mr. Nikonov.
Thank you, Nandan.
And I hope you have a very safe stay.
Thank you. You too. Take care.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Raisina Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe. And for further updates, follow us on our social media and our website.